This is Prescription Life with Dr. Matthew Harrison on Carolina Catholic Radio Charlotte, 1270 AM. Now here is your host for Prescription Life, Dr. Matthew Harrison.
Hello, welcome to the show. Glad to have you back to Prescription Life. This is where we talk about the delivery and promotion of healthcare through a Catholic ethical framework. And I'm really excited today to have Dr. George Delgado with us today. George, are you there?
I'm here. Good morning.
Great. Thank you so much for getting on the show. You woke up bright and early in San Diego on the left coast, and so glad to have you join us.
It's great to be here.
So let me just introduce our audience to Dr. Delgado. He is the president of the Steno Institute. It's a nonprofit research institute established in 2018 with the goal of furthering research, education, and awareness around abortion pill reversal. Dr. Delgado is one of the pioneers of abortion pill reversal and established the Abortion Pill Reversal Network. He has authored or co-authored three articles in peer-reviewed medical journals regarding abortion pill reversal and mifepristone abortion. He received his medical degree from UC Davis and completed his residency at Santa Monica Hospital, UCLA. He's board certified in family medicine and in hospice and palliative medicine. Dr. Delgado completed the one-year certification program in healthcare ethics offered by the National Catholic Bioethics Center. He's a member of the American Association of Pro-Life OB-GYN Board of Directors since 2012. Dr. Delgado was selected to receive multiple awards, including the St. Gianna Mola Pro-Life Award. Heartbeat International awarded him a Servant Leader Award. The Solidarity HealthShare granted him its Pro-Life Innovator Award in 2019 on the eve of the March for Life. And in 2021, Heartbeat International granted him the Legacy Award. The Catholic Medical Association presented him with the Evangelium Vitae Award at its annual conference in 2021. So really privileged to have you here today. And Dr. Delgado is one of my personal heroes. He got in touch with me in 2011 when he was pulling together case reports of abortion pill reversal stories. Tell us a little bit about how you got started with abortion pill reversal and how it's kind of grown and developed into the network that you've headed.
Well, really, it was a call from a woman back in 2011 who was in El Paso, Texas, and she had taken mifepristone and 2009, take a mifepristone in order to start a medical abortion and changed her mind. So she didn't call me directly. She called a woman by the name of Terry Palmquist, who is a sidewalk counselor in Bakersfield, California. So far, far away. But Terry had, and I think still has a website called Lifesavers, and she would carry a cell phone and take calls from all over the country from women who needed support in different crises that they were having. And Terry got the phone call from this woman, and Terry and I had been friends for a while and had never met in person, but we had talked on the phone whenever she had medical questions about different pro-life issues. And so she called me about this one and said, you know, I have this woman who took mifepristone, and now she's changed her mind and she wants to stop a medical abortion. Can you help? And I said, well, Terry, I've never heard of anybody stopping a medical abortion or reversing a medical abortion, but let me give this some thought. And I was in the middle of seeing patients in my office in San Diego at the time, and it was really a Holy Spirit moment because I had some knowledge in my head about using progesterone in pregnancy for women with situations called threatened miscarriage, and this is where a woman's pregnant and she may be cramping or spotting and maybe headed towards miscarriage, and we know that some of those women, if they have low progesterone causing that giving extra progesterone can stop the miscarriage. Well, I knew about that. And for some reason, I had been interested in mifepristone, you know, previously known as RU46, from even before it was approved in the U.S. in the year 2000. So I had read about it probably a lot more than other colleagues, and I knew exactly how it worked, that it worked I thought then was, well, this is a situation of sort of an artificially induced low progesterone state, even though the progesterone levels might be okay, but they're being blocked, they're being ineffective, made ineffective. And I know that when progesterone levels are truly low and we give extra progesterone, we can correct the situation and sometimes save the baby. Perhaps we could give extra progesterone in this situation and it would outcompete the mifepristone until the mifepristone washes out of the system. So I said to Terry, well, I think I have an idea of how we can try something. And I had used progesterone using what are called NAPR technology protocols. And this was, at that time, mostly using injected progesterone. But I figured we'd probably better use higher doses and more frequent doses than used in NAPR technology, which generally was shot twice a week. So on the fly, I basically came up with a protocol of giving the progesterone a couple of 3 days in a row and then every other day and then finally twice a week. But I had one more problem, and that was that I was in San Diego, and this woman who needed help and was crying for help was in El Paso, Texas. So I looked on the web, and I found Dr. Jonathan Bellacura, who was practicing in El Paso, Texas at the time, and I saw that she was using NAPR technology protocols too. So I got her on the phone, and I said, Dr. Bellacura, can you help this woman? This is how I think we ought to dose the progesterone. And she said, well, I have progesterone in the office. I'm willing to do that. And she did. And a few weeks later, I got a call back from her that the baby had survived. And so we had saved this baby's life. And that's how I got started. From there, people started hearing about this, and people started calling me and emailing me, asking for advice. And I was giving advice to other people. And then we started having more and more people involved in a few more cases. And then my colleague, Dr. Mary Davenport, who, along with you, Dr. Harrison, is on the board of Steno Institute, suggested something to me that I'd kind of had in the back of my mind, but I hadn't acted on it yet. And that was, hey, George, why don't you publish a case series of the cases you know about, and let's put this in the literature so that people know about it. And so that gave me the little shove that I needed, and with her help, I wrote that paper, which was the first paper. It described six cases of attempted reversals, and four out of the six were successful. And that's where I first found out about your case. And your case, of course, was the very, very first reversal. Your case had preceded mine by about a year and a half, I believe. And we got all those cases together and published it, and that just created more more people who were interested. And then we realized that we had kind of a problem, and that problem was that, well, there was a window of opportunity between the two drugs, between the mifepristone and the misoprostol. If we want to go into how all that works, we certainly can, but time was of the essence in trying to reverse these medical abortions. And we were finding out that some women weren't finding out about this until it was too late. And the other problem we had was that every time we got a phone call from a woman who wanted help, we had to scramble around to find a woman or a doctor or a clinic in her area that could help her. And that, of course, consumed a lot of time and energy and wasted a lot of time in that window of opportunity. So that's when I decided I better start a network. I want to have a website where women can come and get information and find out what's available. And I want to have doctors who are ready, able, and competent to reverse medical abortions, and then we can contact them very quickly. So that's when I started abortionpillreversal.com. The website started Abortion Pill Reversal, the organization, and I started the network of physicians. I started recruiting physicians, going to different conferences, giving talks, asking around who wants to be in this, and we started growing our network. And at that time, this was under the auspices of Culture of Life Family Services, the nonprofit where I worked in San Diego County. And it really, for those several first years, just started growing organically as we had more more women who were interested, who were calling the hotline, and more doctors and clinics who were interested in joining the hotline.
Yeah, and that's what really amazed me was, you know, two things. One, that you had come up with this independently from from any knowledge of what I had done, you know, in 2006 and seven. And so it really encouraged me thinking that, wow, somebody else has thought that this would work as well. But then on top of that, you really took it and ran with it, which is what I really didn't do. I didn't have the machinery kind of in place to do what you did in setting up the network. And that is what has really made it grown and made available to so many women, and has helped thousands and thousands of women save their babies. And then how did it then transition to Heartbeat International in 2016?
Well, so here's, as it grew, so, and you know, of course, the Gloria and the kudos go to God for doing this. You just use different instruments, and yourself and me, and I certainly consider myself an unworthy instrument, but that's God's choice to use me for whatever job he thinks is right. But he also used a lot of other people, and the leaders of Culture of Life Family Services, our board of directors, were very enthusiastic, and they put themselves a reputation behind it and money behind it and did fundraising for it. We had Vita LaFon, who is a lay person who volunteered to be the first hotline person, and then Debbie Bradle, a nurse, who then became the second hotline person and was really taking call by herself, you know, for several months, and also became our first director. And then my wife, Liz, became the second hotline nurse. And these were very courageous women who were on the front lines and taking these phone calls. It was really wonderful. But what happened was it started to outgrow this local nonprofit in San Diego, and it was becoming an international organization by then. We had contacts in other countries. So we had discussions with Heartbeat International, which, of course, is an international organization and has a lot more institutional depth. And I knew that they were interested in, they saw the potential in abortion pill reversal. And so finally, you know, after discussions about, you know, how we could collaborate, I finally said, you know, hey, what about you guys just taking over the network? And they said, sure, we'd love to do that. And so we, you know, officially sold it to them for $1. And they took over in April of 2018. They wanted the medical protocols and any research, however, to remain with me because they didn't think that was their area of competence. Now, it wasn't necessarily my strong area of competence either, but something I had already gotten started. So I said, certainly. And by that time, I had already published the second large case series, and you were a co-author on that along with Dr. Mary Davenport and others. And that was a very, very interesting article we can talk about later. But then Heartbeat International took over. And at that time, I knew that I needed a platform to continue the research and to continue fine-tuning the medical protocols. And Culture of Life Family Services felt at this point that was probably outside of the scope of the mission of this local organization. And I agreed. And so that's when I started Steno Institute as a nonprofit research institute. And really, our slogan is life-affirming research. And we're laser-focused right now on abortion pill reversal research and improving that and improving awareness and education around that. But in the future, we'll branch out to other pro-life areas in addition as we accomplish more things with abortion pill reversal research. And so we're very happy with the direction that that's going.
Yeah, that's great stuff. And because of the work that you've done and the association that, you know, you've made with Heartbeat International, now there's probably over 1,200 providers that can reverse abortions, and there's been over 3,500 babies that have been saved from medical abortion. And those numbers.
Yeah, we're actually over 4,000 documented babies saved.
Yeah, it's growing exponentially now, logarithmically
now. Over 2,500 doctors, maybe close to 3,000.
Oh, yeah. See, I don't even know the latest statistics because they change so quickly. So very exciting. Well, we're going to come back in a few minutes, and we're going to go over some of the studies. Hold on to the radio.
Carolina Catholic Parish News. Return to God is an evangelizing prayer group affiliated with St. Dorothy's Catholic Church that goes into public squares to bring the love and peace of Jesus Christ to passersby. The group's mission is to be fed by God and to call ourselves, our church, and our country back to God. Begun in 2020, the group plans monthly public prayer events in downtown Lincolnton on the third Saturday of each month from noon to 1 p.m. The Rosary, Divine Mercy Chaplet, and other prayers are prayed at the public prayer events in a living, peaceful manner. The next event will be on January 21st at 1 Court Square in downtown Lincolnton. For information, contact jan1947@aol.com. For the Carolina Catholic Media News, I'm Pam Cullen. God bless y'all.
This is Tammy Harris. I am the founder and executive director of the Ursus Institute. We fight human trafficking both locally and abroad. I'm also a parishioner at St. Gabriel Catholic Church in Charlotte, as well as the Respect Life coordinator there. I urge you to check out my website, www.ursusinstitute.net, or to reach out to me personally at my email, tammy@ursusinstitute.net. Ursus is Latin for bear and is spelled U-R-S-U-S. And my first name, Tammy, is T-A-M-M-Y. We're involved in many operations right now, such as opening a transitional home for survivors in Western North Carolina. We're involved in a documentary about our work and about the realities of human trafficking, both locally and abroad. We're also giving input into anti-human trafficking legislation, involved in intel operations and rescue operations. There's many other things I'd like to share with you, and there's many ways that you can get involved. So I urge you, please text me at 704-519-7901, email me at tammy@ursusinstitute.net, or check out our website, www.ursusinstitute.net. And again, Ursus is spelled U-R-S-U-S. And please be assured that this human trafficking nonprofit works against trafficking in a way that is aligned with Catholic social teaching. Thanks for your time, and I look forward to hearing from you.
Hello and welcome back to the show. We are joined today by Dr. George Delgado, and we're talking about abortion pill reversal, his research and development in that area, as well as the network. George, thanks so much for being here today.
You're very welcome.
So tell me, let's just talk about some basic science. What makes a good and usable study when it comes to researching something such as this?
Well, you know, there are different levels of scientific inquiry, and that's very important for people to know. The most important thing for a study to be useful and important is that there are careful observations that are recorded and different connections are made. And generally, when there's a novel or a new area of inquiry, the first level of study is just simple observation, just somebody being observant and saying, it looks like there's a connection. It looks like when we do A, B happens. And the second, and that's what happened with us.
Yeah, it makes logical, medical, scientific sense.
Yeah, exactly. What I call biologic logic. And mm-hmm. So we knew that progesterone is blocked by mifepristone, and so we decided if we give extra progesterone, we might unblock that block from mifepristone. And I think you came up with the analogy of the false key. We've all had the experience of a key going into a lock, opens the door, but if you put in a key that fits in the lock but doesn't turn the lock, then that blocks the lock, essentially. It doesn't open the door. That's kind of what mifepristone does. So we put in more progesterone in order to fight that. Well, then the second level is to systematically do a review, oftentimes what we call retrospective or a look in the past, and that's where you take records and you see what's happened and what people have taken, and then look at the outcomes. When they do A, you get outcome B. When they do C, they get outcome D. And then you try to figure out a correlation there, and you also can look at, well, when you do A, there are these side effects. When you do B, there are these side effects, or there are no side effects. And it's also a way to look at safety. And this is done very, very commonly in scientific inquiry and very, very useful. Then the next level after that is you want to do what's called a controlled study. And a controlled study is simply where you control things from the outset. It means that you determine, as the researcher, what a subject in the study is going to take, whether that subject is going to take medication at the dose A or medication at the dose B. And sometimes when you have a control study, you have what's called a placebo group. And a placebo group is where, instead of getting an active medication, that the subject gets what's called an inactive medicine, also known as a placebo. And that's the way to test to see if something is really working compared to doing nothing at all. The next level after that, another type of controlled study, is what's called randomized. And that is where you, the researcher, don't pick who gets what, but instead you have a random selection process. These days, usually use a computer program that decides if the subject gets into group A or group B. And so there's no bias on the researcher, even unconscious bias, of choosing who gets to be in which treatment group. And then the next level of a controlled study that you can have is what's called a blinded study. And there can be two types of blinding. The first and probably the most important part of blinding is that the subject, him or herself, does not know which treatment he or she is getting. So you have somehow a disguised treatment so that that person doesn't know what treatment. The second level of blinding is also important, and that is that the treating doctor, it can be blinded to the treatment so that a doctor, him or herself, doesn't know if the subject is getting treatment A or treatment B. And that would be sort of what's considered the highest level of inquiry, when you have all of those things, which, first of all, it's controlled, it's randomized, it's double-blinded, and it's placebo-controlled. So all of those things, you sort of have a hierarchy of leading up to that. But all of it, even from the first earliest observations and the first earliest case reviews, are very, very important and very, very useful.
So give me the kind of the history of abortion pill reversal research and studies that have been done, going from kind of the biological logic to animal studies to people studies.
Sure. So really the research goes back to, we borrow from the actual research done to develop mifepristone itself, which was then called RU486. And the very first studies were studies done on rats, which compared one group of rats that got mifepristone only, and another group of pregnant rats got mifepristone plus progesterone. They were actually given at the same time. And it was found that the group that got mifepristone only, those rats aborted all their pups, while the group that got progesterone, depending on the different concentrations, either didn't abort any pups or they aborted far fewer pups than the ones who just got mifepristone. They also did histologic studies where they cut open these rats, which you're allowed to do with rats, of course not with people, and they saw that the changes in both the ovaries and the uterus caused by the mifepristone were prevented by the administration of progesterone. So those are some of the animal studies. As far as the biologic logic, we know how mifepristone works. It blocks progesterone receptors, competing with progesterone to block those receptors. And we know that in any other biologic system that's ever been studied, whether it's hormones or whether it's enzymes, whenever you have different molecules that are competing for the same receptor or for the same place on another molecule, that if you increase the concentration of one, it's going to outcompete the one that has the lower concentration. And it makes sense. Imagine if you're playing basketball and you have a rebounding drill where you have the red team and the blue team. Well, if you stack it and you put 10 blue players out there and only have 3 red players, well, it's much more likely the blue team's going to get the rebounds. Same thing happens in biologic systems. It's just a numbers game. And so we know that there's biologic logic there. Well, then our first study was a case series where when I became aware of you know, about six cases out there, and I started looking at those with Dr. Davenport. And so we simply looked at the cases. We documented what kind of doses of progesterone they took. What was the time interval between when they took the mifepristone and when they took the progesterone, what the outcomes were, and what any side effects or complications were. And that that gave us the first indication of what I call a signal of that this might really be worthwhile, because four out of the six of the women had successful pregnancies, and they delivered term pregnancies, term babies that were healthy. And so that was very, very encouraging. And that's what kind of got us on the way. Because before that, I had a hunch that this would work, but I really didn't know. You know, I wanted to be very careful because I didn't want to recommend this to anybody not knowing with a great amount of certainty that it would work. But this, although it was a very small study, the results were very convincing. And so that gave us the impetus to go forward and to try to grow the network and to spread the word.
Yes, and so then the follow-up study to that was very much larger, still a retrospective study. Give us an overview of how that developed and the results there.
So we were, you know, as the network was developing, we were taking information from women who were calling us, and we wanted to make sure that they did well because, again, we were starting, this was a novel treatment. And so when women would call us and we would assign them or connect them with a physician or a clinic in their area who would treat them, we were keeping track of them, for, especially because we wanted to make sure that nothing fell through the cracks, that they were getting appropriate treatment, that they were getting all the psychological support they needed and any material support they needed, and that they were getting the progesterone itself, which was most critical early on in the first days, of course. And so in doing so, we were keeping records of these women, with their permission, of course. And after a while, we knew that we had you know, several hundred cases, and it made sense at that point to do an analysis of it, a retrospective case review. And so we started looking at the cases, and because we were following them, we had more information than we did with those first six, which was really just whatever we could gather. And with the information we had been gathering, we were then able to do a systematic review of these case series. We were able to determine for most of them what doses of progesterone they got, because, again, this was not a controlled trial. A controlled trial, you would say, you're going to get so many milligrams and you're going to take it this way. This was a retrospective review, so they had been treated by many different doctors, and they had been given, you know, different doses. Some doctors were using injections, some were using vaginal progesterone, some were giving it orally, and they had used different doses. Sometimes women would start and they would only get one or two doses, and they wouldn't complete the treatment. But we wanted to look at all of them, all comers, and see how they did, and whether their baby survived, and what kind of side effects they had, whether there were preterm deliveries, whether there were any birth defects. So we were able to do that. And first of all, the safety part of it was very exciting because we found that the birth defect rate was about 2.5%, which is equal to the published birth defect rate in the general population. If you look at all births in the United States in any particular year, the birth defect rate is going to be between 2 and 5%. And ours was about 2.5%. So we were very excited about that. So we could conclude that neither exposure to mifepristone nor to progesterone causes birth defects. We also looked at the preterm birth rate, which was very important because, you know, we know that that blocking progesterone could affect placental development. Well, we found out that actually our preterm birth rate was about 2.7%. And in the general population of the United States, it's 10%. And so we were very excited about that, that actually the preterm birth rate was less than the general population. As far as the effectiveness goes, we found that with the best protocols, with the injection protocol, the success rate was 64%. 64% babies survived. And with what we call the high-dose oral protocol, it was 68%. So we're very, very happy with that. When you look at all of the women who even got just one dose of progesterone, the successful reversal rate was 48%. And you might say, well, that sounds kind of low, but it still is statistically better than what we call the historic control. And it, remember, it includes women who just took one progesterone dose and stopped taking it. So anybody who were progesterone touched their system at all. Now, this was using a comparison to what we call the historic control rate, and that was a study by Dr. Mary Davenport. You were a co-author on that, as I was too, and this was looking back at the very first mifepristone studies where they only gave women mifepristone and they did not use the second drug, misoprostol. And with that, they followed some of the cases, some of the studies followed women with ultrasound to determine if the babies had survived. And from that, we could determine that at best, the survival rate after getting mifepristone and not doing anything else was 25%. So if you did nothing at all, 25% of babies will survive if exposed to mifepristone and nothing is done. So that's our comparator. And when you compare those numbers I just mentioned, 48% with all comers, 64% with injection, 68% with high dose oral, they're all what we call statistically significant, meaning that indeed this was not due to chance. This was because the progesterone really was doing something, really was saving babies.
Oh, really great. Great stuff. Thank you so much. That's a good overview and helps us understand how powerful this new delivery of an old medicine really has made a difference in so many lives. Okay, well, thank you. We're going to come back after a short break, and we're going to try to answer some of the objections maybe that folks have had against this research.
Hi, everyone. It's Jason Murphy for the Catholic Men's Conference of the Carolinas and the Obligation Radio Show here on the Carolina Catholic Media Network. Registration is now open for the 13th annual Catholic Men's Conference of the Carolinas to be held on March 18th, 2023 at St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church. It's going to be an amazing day of faith, fellowship, and prayer. Of course, we'll be joined, as always, by our own Bishop Peter Jugas of the Diocese of Charlotte. We also have a great lineup of speakers, including Charles Frawney. Charles is the author of Slaying Dragons, What Exorcists See, and What We Should Know. He's going to be there to discuss spiritual warfare. Also joining us, Jonathan Fanning. He is an author, speaker, an entrepreneur, and a father. Coming to us from High Point, North Carolina, the Diocese of Charlotte, is Deacon John Clark. Deacon is a former NYPD SWAT officer and former MMA fighter. You won't want to miss this one. Scott Wieman is going to be another one of our speakers. He is with Catholic in Recovery. He's going to talk to us about addiction and recovery for Catholics. And our MC this year will be Kevin Spaulding. Kevin is a speaker, an author, and business life coach. You can go online now to www.catholicmenofthecarolinas.org. Make sure to use the promo code RADIO and save $5. We look forward to seeing you there on this awesome day full of faith, fellowship, and prayer. For the Catholic Men's Conference, Carolinas, the Obligation Radio Show, my name is Jason Murphy. God bless, and Esto Vir.
And we just finished going over the published studies regarding abortion pill reversal. And, you know, I've listened to entire podcasts by pro-choice producers who have attacked Dr. Delgado, who have attacked this science and this research and this treatment. It really always amazes me, because it would seem that pro-choice people would want to give women a choice for rescuing or helping their babies. But for some reason, they want to bring this under attack. And so I wanted to spend some time going over the objections so that we could answer those in this forum and see what Dr. Delgado, how he would answer some of these questions. So, Dr. Delgado, so you already answered one question, which was, well, you know, some people say that the babies would survive just as well if you did nothing than if you gave them progesterone. And you went over those numbers, but the pro-choice researchers and doctors say that up to 50% of pregnancies will not end in a completed abortion if you do nothing. So could you help us understand that objection?
I certainly can. Yeah, so this was very commonly a misstatement of facts, at least several years ago, was used. I've seen that they're arguing that less now because they see that we've already successfully countered that point. But there's some definitions that I think are worth explaining for people out there, because terms, unfortunately, are used imprecisely and I think on purpose. The first is, what is an incomplete abortion? An incomplete abortion is simply an abortion where all of the tissue, whether it's a live baby or just dead tissue, has not been expelled from the uterus. So an incomplete abortion does not imply that the baby is still alive. All it means is that there's still some tissue inside the uterus. That's very important to know. But think about it. A woman who wants to reverse mifepristone, she doesn't care about whether her abortion is complete or incomplete. What she cares about is a live baby that she can deliver months down the road. And that's what she cares about. And that's what's important. And that's why it was so critical that Dr. Davenport did that systematic case review of previous studies that she published back in 2017 in the Journal of Issues in Law and Medicine, which is a peer-reviewed journal. Because that looked at the studies where they used ultrasound to detect heartbeats and to see if the babies were actually still alive after they were exposed to mifepristone. So that was a critically important study, because the best survival rate we found was 25%. Now, when you look at incomplete abortion rate or incomplete emptying of the uterus, that is anywhere from 20 to 40%. Now, there was one outlying study that showed 50%, and that's where they've gotten this 50% number. They took that one study, which was kind of an outlier, and said that, well, babies will survive 50% of the time. No, there was one study where there was incomplete emptying of the uterus 50% of the time. But the range of all the other studies was anywhere from 20 to 40% of the time there's incomplete emptying of the uterus. Does not imply embryo survival again. And so it was because of that 20 to 40% incomplete abortion rate that they added the second drug called misoprostol. And the second drug, misoprostol, what it does is it very vigorously stimulates the uterine muscle to contract. It causes uterine squeezing to squeeze out all the contents of the uterus to complete the abortion. So it's kind of a 1-2 punch. The mifepristone kills the preborn baby. The misoprostol ensures that everything is squeezed out of the uterus. And so that's how where they came up with that 50%. And a lot of the anti-life opponents took that and ran with it. Not some of them understood it and they knew what they were doing. They knew they were making false misstatements. The other ones just knew that this was the party line they could take and run with. So I think that was a very disingenuous argument that they had that I think we've countered very, very strongly.
Yeah, now what about, you know, I get people saying, oh, you can't use that medicine. It's off-label. It's not FDA approved for that use. What do you say to that?
Well, what I say to that is that, well, progesterone, first of all, is FDA approved. It's legally used by physicians. It's not, of course, it's in the United States that doctors like you and I write are what we call off-label. And what does off-label mean? Off-label means that a medication has been approved for a certain, what we call an indication, for a certain condition. And for example, there's a medication called terbutaline, which is approved for asthma. But it's been used for many, many years by obstetricians for women in preterm labor to slow down uterine contractions, even though it's not approved for that. And doctors have the legal right and actually the moral responsibility to carefully use medications off-label when there's scientific evidence to support their use in that regard. So what that does is it allows us to use medications that can be very helpful for a condition, even though that drug wasn't specifically approved for that condition. And that's something that's widely accepted, and not only accepted, but expected in the practice of medicine, because like I said, 20% of all prescriptions are off-label. So criticism of that really is quite disingenuous. And in point of fact, mifepristone is currently used off-label because abortionists are using the mifepristone misoprostol combination now for pregnancies that are beyond 10 weeks. And right now the label, the official FDA indication, is that you can use it up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. And previously, they were using mifepristone off-label until the FDA changed the label to allow them to do it the way they are now. So it really is hypocritical for anybody to criticize the use of progesterone in off-label fashion in abortion pill reversal.
Yeah. So you had that very large study that was published in Issues of Law of Medicine, and it was initially published, and then there was a pause in its publication. Can you explain that? Because I've had that have said, oh, well, the study was pulled, et cetera, and they try to say that, you know, there was something wrong with the publication of it.
Actually, there's nothing wrong with the publication. What happened was it was an oversight on our part, and we take full responsibility for that small oversight, and that we got an institutional review board, also known as an ethics board, and these are groups that will review studies to make sure that everything is done ethically and that the most important thing is that patients are not harmed. And of course, with what we call a retrospective review, where you look at records, there's really no possibility of harming patients because essentially you're not doing anything to patients, you're just looking at their records. But nonetheless, we wanted to make sure that we got what's called an IRB exemption, which means that a full review was not needed. And so we submitted this data set, these records, to the IRB, and they gave us their approval. When we went back and we then did the study, we inadvertently included some patients who were not in that original data set that was presented to the IRB. So they were outside of technically what they had approved. So that was the only misstep, and was really just an inadvertent, almost a clerical error, if you will. So because of that, however, we did take the study out of publication, and we, I think, went above and beyond. And what we did then is, and we went to a second IRB, and we gave them the entire data set that we had used, and they went ahead and gave us an exemption because it was the right thing to do. And so then we published the study with just that second IRB approval. So that's what happened there. And of course, those who oppose giving women a second chance at choice, they will use anything they can to try to criticize us. And so they used that to criticize us. And they implied that there was something wrong with our ethics or with our research when it was really just an inadvertent error. Small error, just including some data that was not reviewed, and really nothing at all having to do with the way we did the research or any risk that any patients might have had.
And you know, people will accuse doctors of of giving progesterone injections or having babies survive after being exposed to mifepristone, and they'll say, well, we don't know what's going to happen. There's going to be all kind of birth defects. And you spoke a little bit about that earlier, but I think it's important because it's a main objection that's thrown at this treatment and this research that we don't know what the side effects are, and this is dangerous medicine. How do you address that?
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. It's very, very important to address this very specifically. And the first, we look at mifepristone itself, and all of the previous studies have not shown any connection with birth defects. And in fact, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which has been opposed to what we're doing, and they've been, I would say, vehemently opposed and have been antagonizing us, in two of their practice bulletins, the most recent, which came out in 2020, I believe, they state that mifepristone is not associated with birth defects. So we have this large body that is against what we're doing, but is agreeing with us on that. So that always is worth noting. Secondly, is our large case series of babies exposed to mifepristone is actually now the largest case series in the medical literature showing that there's no increased risk of birth defects with exposure to mifepristone. Now, it is important to note that the second drug in the cocktail, the misoprostol, that does cause birth defects. However, the women we're studying and what we're advocating is stopping the medical abortion before the misoprostol is given. So that's just to make that clear. The other part of the puzzle, of course, is progesterone. Does progesterone cause birth defects? And we know that progesterone has been used in pregnancy very successfully and safely for over 50 years, and there is no evidence of increased risk of birth defects with it. And in our study, again, no increased risk of birth defects. So that gives us a lot of confidence that this is very safe and very effective. Now, we might want to touch a minute on the so-called Crenin study, unless you want to talk about that later. The Crenin study was a study that was conducted by Dr. Mitchell Crenin at UC Davis. It was a randomized controlled blinded study. It was placebo-controlled, and one group got mifepristone only. The other group got mifepristone followed by progesterone, and in that study was stopped because of, quote, safety concerns because of women bleeding excessively. Now, there were three women who bled excessively and called 911. The one who had received progesterone, when she got to the emergency department, she needed no treatment. That is, it was just a failed reversal. The other two were in the placebo group. That is, they did not get progesterone. One of them needed a transfusion. Both of them needed emergent surgical abortions. So what the Crenin study really showed was that not giving progesterone was unsafe. Giving progesterone was actually safe. And the Crenin study also showed that giving progesterone was effective. So the Crenin study really supports what we're doing.
Yeah, obviously, again, very small numbers, but his own study showed 80% survival with progesterone, 40% survival without progesterone, which has kind of backfired on him. Okay, well, thank you very much. When we come back, we're going to talk about what's next for abortion pill reversal, a little bit about the Steno Institute, and how women can access this life-saving treatment.
Pro-life voices across North Carolina will be united again this Right to Life Saturday, January 14th in Raleigh. Join AM 1270 Carolina Catholic Radio for a day of live pro-life broadcasts. Beginning at 10:30 a.m., pray with us during the Rosary and Mass for Life, live from Holy Name of Jesus Cathedral in Raleigh. Then at 1 p.m., Right to Life Saturday continues with the North Carolina March for Life, live from Raleigh. Listen this Saturday beginning at 10:30 on AM 1270 Carolina Catholic Radio.
Rabbi Steve Cunningham with the Census Fidelium Hour, whose purpose for this is to explore the good, the true, the beautiful, while challenging men to become holier and strive for salvation with others and convert and evangelize everyone in between. I am not here to discuss liturgical wars. It is a meaningless and tiresome thing that is a clickbait thing for the bloggers and vloggers out there in the world of the digital realm. I will show the ugly of the world and try to connect the good, true, beautiful to it, as the weapons we have are to be used against the world of flesh, the devil. So keep the joy. Three cheers for joy anyways. God love you, and see you on the flip side.
Carolina Catholic Radio is here to encourage Catholics to learn, love, and live their faith. We're here to go into the breach when the active parishioner leaves the pew, when the inactive or fallen away Catholic needs reminding, and when a Christian is searching for answers only found in the church that Jesus Christ started with his apostles over 2,000 years ago. Please consider making a one-time donation or monthly pledge today. For more information, contact us through our website at CarolinaCatholicRadio.org.
Welcome back, and thanks for joining us today, where we're talking about abortion pill reversal, and we have on the line with us Dr. George Delgado. We've talked a little bit about the research studies going into this, the development of the network, and answering objections to abortion pill reversal. Dr. Delgado, tell me about the Steno Institute, how that came about, and what the goals of this group is.
The Steno Institute came about because we needed a platform in order to conduct pro-life researches, especially focusing on abortion pill reversal. Because the development of this is still early, and we need to have more studies, like the kind of studies that we discussed earlier in the program, at different levels of scientific inquiry. Why is that important? Well, number one is to confirm what we already know about the effectiveness and the safety of using progesterone to reverse mifepristone abortions. Number two is to increase education awareness around abortion pill reversal for the general public, for any woman who finds herself in a situation where she has taken mifepristone and has realized she's made a bad decision and she wants to reverse her medical abortion. Well, she, in order to reverse her medical abortion, she needs to know that reversal is possible. So that awareness needs to be there. And that doesn't just happen. It occurs because people work hard to educate the public. And her friends who give her advice need to know about it. And her doctor that she goes to see or she calls needs to know about it, and not just needs to know about it, but that doctor needs to be confident that this is something that he or she can recommend that it is going to be safe and effective. So all that takes takes a lot of education, takes research, takes knowledge, it takes study, not to mention helping with policymakers and lawmakers who are passing laws that in some states that are requiring an informed consent procedure that a woman needs to be told about abortion pill reversal before the abortion process can start. So Steno Institute is founded in order to increase that education awareness and research around abortion pill reversal, to spread the word, to increase our knowledge, and to fine-tune our protocols to make sure that we're offering the very, very best treatments and the very safest treatments to these women who want a second chance at life.
And how would people find out more about the Steno Institute, or if they wanted to become involved in it, or if they wanted to apply for a research grant?
So they should go to stenoinstitute.org, STENOinstitute.org. There they can find out all sorts of information about Steno Institute. They can go to our resource page and find all of our different published articles. They can find other articles and videos. videos about abortion, pro-reverse, and about other pro-life topics, and they can read about our history. And there also is an opportunity to donate there online if they want to support our efforts, which are very, very important. And if those scientists or doctors who are interested in pro-life research want to see about collaborating with us, then they can also email us through the website there, and we can talk about collaboration. Right now we have a couple of human studies that are in the planning stages. One actually a controlled, randomized controlled trial of giving women different progesterone treatment protocols and seeing which one works better. The other would be another retrospective review. And we've been collaborating with Dr. Stephen Samut at Franciscan University of Steubenville, who is a neuroscientist who has developed a rat model of abortion pill reversal that very closely mimics the human model. Earlier in the segment, I mentioned the early studies of mifepristone done in rats, where the mifepristone and progesterone was given at the same time. Well, that shows what that truly shows is that progesterone blocks, prevents the effect of the mifepristone. But of course, in the human experience, when a woman undergoes an abortion pill reversal, first she takes the mifepristone, later she takes the progesterone. She's not going to take them both at the same time. Well, so Dr. Samut developed a rat model where exactly what he does. He gives the mifepristone first, then he gives the progesterone second. And so that really is a much better model to study what happens in the humans. And he has a paper that is being submitted right now for publication showing that the rats that were given progesterone after the mifepristone had reversals of the effects of the mifepristone. So very, very exciting things he's doing in his lab. In the future, we'll try other FDA-approved medications to see if they can help boost the effects of progesterone and other progesterone strategies and other hormones to see if they can have an effect on improving the effectiveness of the abortion pill reversal and at the same time studying the safety of those different treatments. So, in addition, other plans we have with Steno Institute as far as future endeavors, we also want to look at the psychological aspects of the woman choosing medical abortion, what sort of makes her tick and why she does that, and then what is involved in the psychology of her choosing reversal. So we think that knowing these things will help us give guidance to counselors who are helping women navigate these waters, and having psychological insight into that. I think we'll help these counselors do a better job. We'll help them connect better with these women who are in crisis and really give the women themselves more insight into what they've chosen and what the choices are that lie ahead of them.
Yes, and, you know, these studies that you described will really answer one of the main objections that, you know, anti-life folks have, in that, oh, well, your studies aren't controlled, you don't have placebos and that type of thing. And that just shows a complete misunderstanding of scientific research, of how science studies are performed and developed, and then understanding the situation of these women who are really in crisis. You know, this is, you know, what they are describing is kind of like saying, oh, well, let's give, you know, 1,000 people cancer and give half of those people the treatment and then half the people placebo. You know, that would be completely unethical, and we can't do that in a situation of crisis like these women are in.
Yeah, sure, you're absolutely right. And just a couple of points on that, because I think you really raise a great issue there. Think about CPR. When CPR was first developed, there was never a placebo-controlled trial where when a person went down with a heart attack, you just stood there and tapped your finger and said, okay, let's see if the heart restarts by itself. No, that was totally unethical. That was never done. It never will be done. An abortion pill reversal is quite analogous to CPR. It's CPR for the unborn baby who's been exposed to a toxic drug. So it would be totally unethical to have a placebo group. And in the Cronin study, study itself showed the perils of having a placebo group, because those two women who had to have emergency abortions because of bleeding, they were in the placebo group. The next thing is that this also shows the hypocrisy of those who oppose it, because many people do not realize that the main study that was used by the FDA to approve mifepristone itself back in 2000, this study did not have a placebo arm. There was no placebo group when mifepristone was approved for use in the United States women who wanted to have abortions. So they didn't have a placebo group, and they have their approval study, but now they're expecting us to conduct placebo-controlled trials. That, to me, is the height of hypocrisy.
Yeah, so in the last few minutes that we have available to us, you know, teleabortions are starting to explode. Medical abortions are now probably at least 50% of all abortions. And there are many that are done through the mail, done kind of illegally and under the table. And so we're going to be seeing a rise in the need for the, you know, the rescue of these babies and the mothers. So let's go through the logistics of exactly what happens, how a woman accesses abortion pill reversal. So a woman goes, gets the abortion pill. She leaves the clinic after taking the abortion pill in front of them, and she's supposed to take the Cytotec or misoprostol either 24 to 48 hours later. And maybe they're looking on their phone. They have a mobile app. They see something on the internet about, can I reverse this abortion? Then what happens? How do they access the network?
So they go online, they read about abortion pill reversal on the abortionpillreversal.com website. After reading about it and getting a lot of information, and by the way, they get more information on that website than they get at the Planned Parenthood or whoever else gives them the mifepristone abortion pill. Then if they want to proceed, then there's a chat box there that they can start chatting, or they can call the phone number to the hotline. Either way, they're accessing the hotline, and the hotline operator then will ask some questions, determine that, yes, this person did take mifepristone and is interested in reversal. And at that point, we'll connect the person with a nurse, who's the actual hotline nurse, after that initial screening. And then the nurse will ask more medically-based questions, health-based questions, find out, confirm when actually the mifepristone was taken, confirm she has not taken misoprostol, the second drug, then answer any other questions so that the woman is fully informed about what she's going to do. There's no pressuring like we've heard about at abortion centers. They're just giving good, factual information and giving a supportive ear and all the time that she needs. Then, at that point, if the woman determines that she wants to proceed with reversal, then the hotline nurse will get her to sign some documents that state that she's giving permission for a physician to be contacted, and then the contact is made with the physician in the woman's area, who is knowledgeable, competent, and willing to treat her. And then the physician it gets in contact with the woman and starts the treatment.
Yes, and so those websites, abortionpillreversal.com, there's also abortionpillrescue.com. People can also access it through Heartbeat International website. And then anyone who wants to volunteer at these kind of medical pregnancy centers or in doctor's offices, there are ways to get involved in abortion pill reversal. If you want to volunteer or work for the network, there are ways to get involved with that in helping spread the word and making these available. I have friends that literally they stand on the sidewalk at the abortion clinic with a giant sign that says, "Did you change your mind? Abortionpillreversal.com." And it has the phone number, and they give them information right there outside of the abortion clinic. So we're trying to make this as accessible to folks as possible, and then trying to support these moms who are in crisis to get them through this. Dr. Delgado, thank you so much for taking an hour out of your very busy schedule. We'll definitely have you back in the future for some more topics of interest. Thanks again for coming on. Anything you'd like to say to our audience before you leave?
I would just say, all of you have a sphere of influence. You have people that trust you, that know you. Please tell them about abortion pill reversal. Tell them that women who take mifepristone now have a second chance at life.
Thank you very much. You have a great day. And thanks, everyone, for joining us at Prescription Life. Have a great day.
You've been listening to Prescription Life with Dr. Matthew Harrison on the Carolina Catholic Radio Network, 1270 AM Charlotte, and streaming at carolinacatholicmedia.org and on the Carolina Catholic Media app.